Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to our first book club of series 2. We're back. Hope you had a good August. And I'm delighted to be talking to Erin Kelly about her fabulous book, The Skeleton Key. Hello, Erin. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good.
Good, good. Before we start, can you tell us a bit about yourself and who you are, Erin, for those who might not know?
I'm a novelist. I think The Skeleton Key is my 9th psychological thriller. So I write standalone books, crime fiction, but not really police books. So I don't write the kind of book where you start with a chalk outline and then in comes the detective. I used to be a journalist, but I was an appalling journalist. I only really became a journalist because someone told me that it was a kind of easy platform to get a novel published. And I teach creative writing as well too.
Okay. And is that a good platform to become a novelist? There are quite a lot of journalists who become novelists. So is that a good way in for people who want to be novelists?
Well, it is, except it takes a bloody long time to become a journalist. It's not, you know, you don't just go and knock on Mr. Murdoch's door and say, can I have a job? Well, certainly not if you've got my kind of background. But it's actually really good because it stops you being scared of a blank page. And I meet lots of beginning writers who don't feel permission or don't have any sense of entitlement that this is something you can do. And I got all of that out of the way being a journalist, all that kind of imposter syndrome. So by the time I came to write my first book, I'd been writing for magazines and newspapers for about 10 years. So, it's helpful in that way. Actually, very often novelists make journalists make appalling novelists to begin with because they're so trained in not departing from the facts and being super economical and not delving and there's no kind of supposition. But
yeah,
it's a good, I think it's a good as training ground as any.
Cool. And so this is the first of your books I've read. I did very much enjoy it, so I will be seeking out some of the others. Which are your favourites of your previous books? I know one of them was in the Richard and Judy Book Club, and there is no higher accolade than that as being a novelist. So
I think Julian Barnes genuinely said he was more excited about the Richard and Judy Book Club than he was the Booker. I've been in it three times, actually, and I personally would take the Booker over it. My favourite of my books is probably my third novel, which was called The Burning Air, and it was a bonfire night thriller about a kidnapping set in Devon, in one of those quite bonkers festivals that we do so well in this country, where yokels carry tar barrels and flaming on their backs. And that was a book that I really loved and I'm proud of, and it didn't necessarily reach as many readers as I wanted it to. So that's my, when people ask me, what shall I read? I always say, go and read The Burning Air and show it.
Do you find, I mean, obviously you've had very successful novels. Do people go back and pick them all up and start from the beginning? Well, they're not connected, are they? But if they go back and read your other works, are you finding that?
No. Yeah, you do. And that's the good thing about writing standalone books as opposed to series fiction, is that they can pick them up and read them in any order. Most people's entry point is a book called He Said, She Said, which is my biggest hit. That's about 4 or 5 years ago now. But it's a good thing to have a breakout book a good way into your career, because then you have a backlist. Yeah. And there's, passive income's the dream, isn't it? So.
Although it's doing well enough with those early books to be able to do extra books afterwards is obviously it's a difficult balance. It's amazing. Anyone who gets published should be very proud of themselves. But once you've got up to book nine, then I think that's probably a vote of confidence from somewhere. So The Skeleton Key, which was recommended to me by previous guest Stephanie Merritt, who'd read an advanced copy, as I have. It's the sort of starting point of it which intrigued me, is those sort of 1970s, well, is Masquerade, which was this puzzle book from the 1970s, but not just that. Do you want to talk a little bit about why that was an influence and what your other influences were for the start of this idea?
Yeah, well, since starting to publicise The Skeleton Key, I have realised that the world is full of people who've never heard of Masquerade and people who are completely obsessed with it. And there doesn't seem to be any real in between. So Masquerade was a picture book. It was published in 1978 by the artist Kit Williams. And it's a beautiful picture book. It works. I mean, I had it when I was little and I didn't really understand that it was a treasure hunt book. It works as a children's story book. The photos are, the pictures are, it's a kind of photorealistic painting, but they're very surreal. So you've got kind of giant puppets and animals. I'm actually looking at my wall now because I cut up a paperback copy of it and I've had it plastered on my walls for the last year to give me inspiration. So I can see a man and a woman dressed as the sun and the moon dancing around a globe upon which sits a man who is half a hare playing a violin. So that gives you, it's bonkers and very surreal and quite trippy. And there are words in the borders around the pictures, and each picture puts together a clue to solve a master riddle. And when the master riddle is solved, or when the master riddle was solved, it led to a buried jewel, a golden hare, which was buried somewhere in England, Bedfordshire, it turned out to be. And it was a real sensation at the time. It was, when Masquerade was published, we only had three channels and the pubs all closed in the afternoon. So it was in a time where a book really could be a phenomenon in the way that it in a very pure way that it can't now. It genuinely has to be word of mouth. And people became absolutely obsessed with it. I mean, marriages broke down because one spouse would neglect the other to spend the evenings trying to decipher the pictures and the codes. And it was a really extraordinary thing, which, I mean, when I was four, I just thought it was a cute picture book. And it's a bit like the Narnia books in that you can, but without the without the sort of thumping, terrifying theological background. That you can read it, you can go back to it. You read it once as a kid and it's a beautiful thing. And then you read it again as a teenager and you see subtext, and then you can read it as an adult and you can really give the pictures a go. It's always been part of my life. And then I got it out again when my kids were preschoolers to read them the story. And I started thinking, what would it be like if this book was published now, because it's so a book. What would it be like now when people would be trading information on the internet and there would be chat rooms with people, you know, threatening to murder and rape each other because they didn't agree with the solutions, and there would be, you know, there would be some men typing that women shouldn't be searching, you know, all of the things that happen now. I started wondering how would Masquerade be received now? Yeah. And in the last decade, there was something similar in the States, and it was called Forest Fen, The Thrill of the Chase. It was a treasure chest in a map buried somewhere in the Rocky Mountains. And that treasure hunt, with the clues again hidden in a book, that did happen in the internet age. And people died looking for it. I mean, it was hidden in the Rocky Mountains, which is slightly more challenging terrain than Bedfordshire. So people fell down crevices. They sort of drifted off on rafts, never to be seen again. People accused each other of hacking into their hard drives to steal the solutions. And that level of obsession, coupled with the sort of original childhood love of Masquerade, was what made me think there are people who would kill for it, yeah, to learn a secret like this. There are people whose lives are devoted. And if it happened now, there were examples online of the kind of vitriol and the weirdness that people can read into something that often isn't even there. I think often with, yeah, these treasure books, the wrong solutions are much more intriguing than the right ones, because you can, it's a really interesting, especially in this kind of age of post-truth fake news, you can see people presented with the same facts, and our reading is so varied and so oppositional in lots of ways. It's really, it was a really interesting study into how one person can take one tiny piece of information and run in the complete opposite direction with it, and develop something that's almost a religion or a cult out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it is about obsessions, as well as being about family, which we'll get on to later. But it might strike people as being, it's sort of, the book begins with someone basically attacking the narrator of most of the book. Trying to get inside her because they think the solution is inside her, let's say, which might seem extreme. But then, you know, as you say, I was looking at the Masquerade Wikipedia page, and Bamber Gascoigne said of Masquerade, tens of thousands of letters from masqueraders have convinced me that the human mind has an equal capacity for pattern matching and self-deception. While some addicts were busy cooking the riddle, others were more single-mindedly continuing their pursuit of the hair, quite regardless of the news that had been found. Their own theories had come to be seem so convincing that no exterior evidence could refute them. These most determined of masqueraders may grudgingly have accepted that a hair of some sort was dug up at Amtill, but they believed there would be another hair or a better solution awaiting them at their favourite spot, which is sort of what the book is about. It's about people refusing to accept the
believe words. The evidence of their eyes. But there's so many parallels in, you know, climate change deniers and the anti-vaxxer movement, whereby it's said, isn't it, that the way you tell whether someone is a conspiracist or a conspiracy theorist is you say, well, what would it take to change your mind? And if they say nothing, then you've lost them. And that's the kind of mindset I wanted to explore, but with treasure hunts rather than globally terrifying
mistakes. Yeah. Yeah, well, I always thought there was something in when comedy chat rooms started up very early, people were so vociferous about their beliefs in comedy and who was and wasn't funny. And it reached this stage where a certain chat room, everyone would start agreeing with each other and saying, what's the opinion of the chat room on this, before they dared profess their own opinion. So that you'd get these very strongly held cliques, basically, and some of them pleasant and some of them nasty. And that's a bit what the treasure hunters aspect of this is like, is that some of them are obviously fairly murderous or approaching murder. Yeah. And then some of them are obsequious and trying to sort of, they're all sort of trying to cross a line, because obviously they want to get into the real lives of the family that the book is actually about. And some of them do that through ingratiating themselves or trying to be nice, but they still feel special, even the people who are helping, I suppose, feel special because they're getting some extra information and they're crossing the line. So it's very interesting in terms of fandom and the way that fans can easily turn against the very that they sort of
really interesting to me as well, the way I'm not saying that I spend my entire life on Twitter, but I do I do think it's just such a fascinating place to learn about, you know, human psychology and the rabbit holes we can go down. And that's what you would see, you know, the way that the more beloved a figure is, the stronger the vitriol is when they are, you know, when they're temporarily cancelled or they say something that doesn't chime with the fans' views.
But it's amazing, you know, that some of the fans, I mean, it's not amazing, but it's very truthful that some of the fans actually hate the guy who's created the book. As it turns out, he's not the nicest person in the world, the man who's created
the book. He's not a great guy.
So we veer into other issues via him, which I suppose really the book's, as much as being a thriller and having an element of mystery as to why certain things have happened and whether there's been murders and that sort of thing. It's really about a family and quite a dysfunctional family, and which is sort of headed by a narcissist who's very competitive with his best friend and isn't a great guy and not very nice to his daughter, certainly. So it's because it's told from her perspective. She's sort of rejected a lot of the family, even at the start of the book.
Yeah. So for context, the actual plot of the book is that the author, the head of the family, Frank Churcher, who has been made a knight for his services to art, is the author of the book, and the book caused a lot of trouble for his family. It's called The Golden Bones, the book in my book. And I've always wanted to write a book within a book. And I think most authors end up doing that. If they hang around for long enough, you get to your book within a book one. Everyone's also got a People Going Mad on an Island book, but I haven't reached mine yet. So my book within a book, The Golden Bones, is the fictional treasure hunt book. And like the Forest Fenn book, A Man Died Searching for It, and also Frank's daughter, who is the narrator of the book and the person that we see being attacked in the opening pages, she becomes the object of treasure hunters' interest because they believe that she is a character from the book. And the treasure here isn't a golden hair, it's a little golden skeleton, which has been scattered into seven parts, so seven clues in the book, and they've all been found apart from one bone, the pelvic bone. And on the 50th anniversary of the book's publication, Frank decides to reissue the book and reveal the hiding place for the last piece of treasure. And instead of digging up a little golden bone, they find a real human female pelvis. And that is when we realise that people are, you know, the threats are not just on the surface, that something somewhere has gone very wrong. And it's a chain of events that would never have happened if this book had never been published. And I liked the idea. I mean, I set it in the, I let it begin in the kind of 60s and 70s, partly because I wanted to write about my parents' generation and the kind of boomer mentality that this is a generation that's had every single advantage. And I suppose they were, you know, ostensibly they were enlightened, but actually free love probably did as much damage as it did good. And I wanted to compare that with the, you know, how that attitude changes and that sense of privilege as it goes down the generations.
Yeah, well, it's an incredibly gripping book. I have to say, I was really into it. I read it within about 3 days. It's not a short book. It's, you know, a good chunky book, but it just keeps you gripped. And it's very, the writing's very, you know, you keep people guessing, and you're very tricksy as well. There was one bit I had to turn back to find out what the hell had happened because you tricked me quite convincingly. I won't say any more than that. I don't think it's obvious what I mean until you've read the book. But it's beautifully written. It's very evocative, and the pacing's amazing, and the prose of it is also terrific. So it's a gripping book that I think people will really enjoy. I read it as well because I didn't have the audiobook. I usually use the audiobooks, but I found it much more gripping for being read, actually. So it was kind of fun.
I don't think we've got
Have you not? No, okay. Well, there probably will be one by the time this goes out.
There will be,
okay,
yeah.
Well, but by the time this goes out, you can do, and I'm sure it will work very well as an audiobook, but it's been a while since I've had a book that, you know, you've got there by the side of your bed and you're sort of trying to get through to find out what happens before you fall asleep. I didn't quite stay up all night reading it, but I did stay up late, longer than I intended to, as I tried to work out what was happening. And so, you know, there's a mystery within it, and there's a thing to, you know, there's
things to wonder about and guess and try and second guess, which you probably won't manage to do.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Did you think about, obviously the books, what was interesting about it is that this huge success turns in for the family turns into being quite a burdensome albatross around their neck, really, as they're sort of haunted by this story that Frank is unable to be seen seriously as a proper artist, or wants to be seen as a proper artist, and obviously it has violent repercussions on his family. So you probably wouldn't have thought about this having written this book, but was there any point where you thought, I'll try and write the book within the book and hide some stuff and see?
My goodness. No, there's no Easter eggs that relate to anything outside the story. What actually was the hardest bit, though, was writing. So there is a book within a book to be written, and I thought, I can't write my, well, obviously what I can't do is, sadly, paint beautiful pictures and show you that. There's a folk song at the end of the book, which I did write, which is which one of my friends has recorded, actually, which is the kind of origin of the myth that fed into the story. I'm digressing here. But what the thing about the clues in treasure hunt books, and Masquerade's not the only one. Like I said, there's been Forest Fenn, and there's a big American one called The Secret, and there's one that's ongoing at the moment in Wiltshire, which is quite similar to Masquerade. And the clues are, what interests me is not the clues themselves. So they can be anagrams or ciphers. You know, it all gets a bit Da Vinci Code when you get into the actual clues. So the solution to Masquerade, I'll give you an example of how esoteric these are and what a mental leap they are. So the way to solve the clues in Masquerade is you look at a bird or an animal or a person in the picture, and you draw a line from their eyes through their longest finger or toe, and that picks out a letter on the edge, and then that gives you a bundle of letters which you must make into a sentence, which itself becomes a clue. And the sentence it makes, I think I've got it written down somewhere, is... Catherine's long finger overshadows earth buried. Yellow amulet points the hour in light of equinox. Look you. And from that, people worked out that it was in a park in Bedfordshire where the shadow of St. Catherine's cross hit the ground in a certain, the shadow hits a certain point during the summer equinox, and that's where you had to dig. And someone got there. You could put me on a desert island with that book for the rest of my life, and I wouldn't even come close to working that out. But I did have to put a couple of clues in, and it was just so, I can't even do a cryptic crossword or a Sudoku. So that was the hardest part of the book. It wasn't the kind of misdirection and the usual plotting. It was writing a bloody sodding clue to come up with it. And in the end, I just put one in, and I just... it was something about King Arthur in Highgate Cemetery, and it was just fudging it. But that, almost, I think, about a week before I gave the book to my editor, I still didn't know what that clue was going to be, only that it had to be misinterpreted and lead to all sorts of trouble. So
yeah.
I'm not a natural treasure hunter at all. Really not.
Well, it's sort of the whole thing with Masquerade, because I did try, you know, I'm a little older than you, and I did try to solve it as, I guess, a 12-year-old or 11 or 12-year-old with my friend Steve Cheek. I mean, we went to the library for an afternoon after school. I think it was probably the extent of it. But the balance is you've got to make something that's solvable but not immediately solvable.
Yeah.
And there was a chance with that. I mean, within Masquerade, it was all like there was different pictures that gave you the keys, and then the animals were in a different order in one thing. Though there has been a book written, I'm sure, and there is a book to be written about what actually happened with Masquerade, because obviously there was a lot of subterfuge.
And I think there's a screenplay in development at the moment,
right?
Because when it was found, actually two people did solve it, but in the meantime, the artist's ex-girlfriend had given her new boyfriend the clue as to where she thought it might be, and he dug it up. So when it was found, it was, you know, the guy cheated. So, yeah, the story of the search is as bonkers as the treasure hunt itself, which I love.
But even what the way he claimed he'd solved it was, you could have solved it just because there was a clue about Catherine of Aragon, 1 of 6 to 8, which I didn't even work that out. And then there were crossed fingers over the equinox. So you could have sort of worked out it's something to do with Catherine of Aragon, and it's got to be a shadow. You know, you could work backwards, which is what that guy claimed to do, but then didn't actually do. But yeah, it's nuts. It was, and that's why I think for anyone of my generation and older, I guess this was such a big deal, Masquerade, that I think. Mm-hmm. That will resonate with lots of people, but equally, you don't need to. I mean, this book is not about Masquerade, and in no way connected with Masquerade beyond the initial idea. So it's, you don't have to have be aware of Masquerade to get any enjoyment out of this. I'm sort of interested in the process of writing a thriller like this, and getting the plot to work and get the surprises to come at the right place, and the misdirections, and is that the most laborious thing about it? Do you plan it all out? You must have to plan some book like this in advance before you write it.
I don't plan in advance. So I plot by writing, and the way that I usually do that is I will start with a central scene, which in this case was the treasure being uncovered and it turning out to be a human bone. Now, that doesn't actually happen to the extent that I'm wondering if I've spoiled my own book now, but probably not. That doesn't happen until about a quarter of the way into the book. So I had that central scene, and I thought, well, I've got to give a bit of backstory leading up to that, but I don't want to do too much info dumping, so I need to ask questions and create intrigue as well. And then, you know, each scene will need a character, and I'll think, well, who are the witnesses here? Let's get a film crew in so that everything is documented, because that will help me out later in the book when they're going through the camera footage to see what happened and who's been where. And I use a program called Scrivener, which is essentially a word processing document, but it's got columns. So if you're looking at your screen, you've got your blank page in the middle. Hopefully it's not blank forever, but, you know, but on a good day, it's not blank. And the left-hand side, you can have, you can mark out your chapters almost like in a DVD menu. You know, so I can say, for example, Nell comes back to the house. Nell finds out that her stalker is there with headings. And then you can, it's very, very easy. Unlike in a Microsoft Word document where you've got to scroll all the way up and down, you can very easily pick chapters and move them around. And I do that a lot. It's often, I often find that I know exactly what's happening in the book, but the plotting is about the order in which it happens. I don't write chronologically or linearly. I just keep going and write layers. And I write it, the first version is a proper vomit draft. You know, it's very rough and pretty much unintelligible to anyone but me. And then I will keep tidying it and keep tidying it. And then there's the real treat is the last draft, where you're kind of, you were very kind about my prose, but that's the joy, because that's when you can kind of set it to music and put all the finishing touches on, knowing that and usually somebody else has seen it by then, just to make sure that, you know, people don't suddenly appear from rooms that they couldn't possibly have been in, or change ages three times in a single scene. So that's the bit that I love. And plotting is it's laborious in that it's very labor intensive, but I really love it. I really, yeah. it's the hardest part, but it's also, when it comes together, it's just a really wonderful feeling.
And in terms of, I mean, so how long does it, how long would a book like this take you to write? And what, and I'm presuming, it, you know, it's now a full-time occupation, so that's...
Yeah, it is my sort of full-time the time it takes. Job. So usually I would say a year and a half for a right. book, but I started this in lockdown, and I actually can't tell you anything that happened over the last 3 years and pin it down to any sense of time, because... things start, they stop, you know, and so I think it was very quickly written, because I had a long, long time to think about it. I think the first draft was about 10 months, and then I gave it to my editor really confident, and then she said, yeah, you you need to, there are some things that aren't working here. And she was absolutely right on all counts, but then there was a rewrite, which was another 4 months or so. So, yeah, probably about a year and a half per book. I'd love to be able to write a book a year, to do a Grisham or a Rankin, you know, when you hit the ground running and you've got a certain month of the year that you know you're always published in. And but I've got, I think I'm a bit too much of a parent, a hands-on parent, to be able to make that work.
Well, that's a good thing. And yeah, what's quite enjoyable about this book is the first book I've read that is post COVID. So it's so it actually, you know, COVID has happened, and that's about, so it mentions, I've read a lot of books that go, this was written during COVID, but this is the first book I've read that sort of novel anyway, that is COVID has just happened and is referenced, but it's not, but equally it's not about COVID. So nice,
yeah, there were some helpful things. I mean, I think in the book I say that the Golden Bones, my fictional book, and the online version of the treasure hunt was a lockdown activity they did because they realised that families, you know, do want to get out and look for stuff in nature. So yeah, it's referenced, but essentially I am going to write books that there's just this kind of 2 year gap in the middle, especially with crime and thriller writers. We were all saying, what do we do? Because one of the things about crime fiction is that probably more so than any other genre, certainly often more than, you know, when a great man of letters takes to his keyboard, I think crime has to so accurately capture the time it's in. You know, everything has to be right, from the way that we use technology to the social issues of the day. And we were all looking at each other thinking, well, if we write something that's set now, it's going to be out of date by the time, you know, chapter 8 will be obsolete by the time... chapter 16 is finished, so where do we go from there? So there's just going to be this void of 2 years when no crime was committed. So I think crime fiction kind of ends in 2019 and then picks back up again in 2021.
I mean, there's a few things in research terms I was interested in, because you've said you're not an artist, or you've implied you're not an artist, and yet the art seems very well described in the process of creating art, and glass working especially, and also... living on a barge, which I'm looking at your room, and I don't think that's on a barge.
No, so
how much
you're in Barnet, it's very much not floating.
you definitely captured you definitely captured that lifestyle for Nell. What level of research do you do for that, or was that based on something you'd encountered previously?
No, I made her live on a barge because, as someone with a stalker, she wanted to keep moving. And I wanted her in London, but also isolated.
Yeah.
I booked an Airbnb actually when lockdown ended. It was brilliant. So I stayed on a boat in Little Venice for a week to finish my first draft of the book. And so I got an idea. I mean, I didn't get to pilot the boat, which is probably, for the sake of everybody on the Grand Union Canal, probably a really good idea. But I did, get to understand the claustrophobia and a bit about the community, and found out more about chemical toilets than I ever want to know. So that was a really joyful piece of research. And then there was a stained glass artist who I interviewed and said, you know, how do you go about your day? And loads of stained glass artists on Instagram. And I'm not an artist, but I am an art lover. And I read lots of art biographies, and I interviewed Kit Williams, art dealer, actually, about what life had been like in the 70s and how she sold his paintings, and the kind of snobbery of, you know, what's it like when your paintings are not fashionable but people still really love them. And then I also read lots of, there's a really good book, I think it's up on my shelf, called The Art of Rivalry, and it's about rivalries between male artists. So you've got, or friendship between male artists and how there's always competition. So it's got Van Gogh and Gauguin and Francis Bacon and Lucian Freud. So, you know, there's just juicy inspiration everywhere on lots of accounts. But this was a very research heavy book because I had to research treasure hunters, boats, stained glass, the art world. And then when you get to the actual buried body part of the book, I also had to know a lot about anatomy and decomposition. And...
I was going to ask you about that because it seems you seem very knowledgeable about how a body decomposes and what different things would affect things. I was a bit scared to meet you in terms of whether you'd that was through research or knowledge.
There's a forensic pathologist who I work with who was for a long time the advisor on Silent Witness. And once a year, I'll send him an email saying, me again. he's just helped me. I think he's probably helped me murder, dispose of 7 or 8 bodies now.
Okay.
So, yeah.
It's very well described, that particular body. Do you think you would, I'm sure you get asked this all the time, do you think you would make a good murderer yourself through having done all these things if there was someone you wanted? You just looked away there. And I think that indicates that you have murdered someone.
Which direction did my eyes go in? You can tell. We've just established then that I've got no poker face whatsoever. So. I might be able to help somebody cover one up. I think I'd be quite good at that. I don't think I could be asked to murder anyone. I'm just tired all the time. It's hard work, you know.
Yeah.
It's going to take you away from the desk for days and days. It's not compatible with deadlines.
I'm not sure that the way this particular body gets hidden is too practical eventually as for a murderer, or it's a bit of a risk anyway. But, I did also love, I think the family relationships are great, but the relationship between Frank and his friend Lal, is it? They're sort of best friends, but they're obviously also rivals, or certainly from Frank's position, it feels like he's always trying to get one over. I've experienced that kind of relationship where it's just everything, however awful, and there's a couple of awful things towards the end that he's done. It's sort of about just even knowing you've bettered the other person without even necessarily them or beaten the other person that's very well observed, which I guess comes again from some of those artists you were talking about researching that they were.
People who don't read many thrillers presume that they're all about evil with a capital E, you know, somebody's stroking a bald cat and laughing as they think about their evil deeds. But actually, I think insecurity and cowardice are much more interesting motivators, because that's what Frank is. He's an insecure man for whom no amount of success will ever be enough. And everything he's doing is not necessarily out of a sense of grandiosity so much as to stave off the idea that he's not good enough, that he's inferior in some way, and everybody's felt that, haven't they? I think what the point of a good gothic thriller is to take elements that we'll all have experienced and then just blow them up into the most extreme situations possible.
Yes, but it's also, you know, it's interesting because he's had this huge success and he's still not happy with it. So nothing would really make, I mean, he has aspirations as an artist, I suppose, but one thinks that even if those came good, which I suppose to an extent they do anyway, that he still wouldn't be satisfied. He'd still be searching for the next thing. So he's a horrible, just his relationship with his daughter, which is right from the beginning, you know, to have that situation where she's nearly been killed. And it's still not, it sort of hasn't really even, I mean, not that it's exactly his fault, but it's certainly an inspiration for that crime. You'd think that as a father to a daughter, there would be more,
one would hope,
but I think that's definitely, it's definitely true of the character. So it all makes sense, as to why everyone's acting the way they are. And it's, but you know, you learn a lot about the family as we go, and that's the, as the layers fall away. So it is, it's beautiful. It is, the pacing of it's beautiful. It's just brilliantly put together. Let's talk about what's coming up next for you. Are you working on your next one already, I presume?
Yeah, I'm working on a book which is still in its infancy, but it's essentially about a woman who inherits a collection of dresses, vintage clothes from somebody who's dead, and finds mysteries and clues inside the dresses. But not quite sure where that's going yet, but I'm having real fun with it.
Good. And do you read a lot of other people's works, and
what am I reading at the moment? The last great novel I read was one that I think is either, it will have been published by the time your podcast goes out. It's called The Half-Life of Valeri K by Natasha Pulley. And it's about it starts off in a Siberian gulag, and one of my obsessions is Soviet history. And it's about a Soviet nuclear physicist who is plucked from a gulag and then is drawn into work in a kind of social experiment run by the Soviets to see basically how hard you can nuke a human population before it all goes absolutely to shit. And it's really bleak. I mean, it takes in kind of eugenics and the Nazi party, and it's one of the funniest books I've ever read. So it's got that, in the same way that Catch-22 made the war hilarious. That's or almost like a Mick Herron book where it's very, very funny throughout. So I love authors who can make the bleak really, really funny. And I am listening to an audio book as well at the moment, which is by DJ Fat Tony, and it's called I Don't Take Requests. And it's about being a DJ in the 90s and best mates with Boy George. And he's just he's just a terrible person. It's just one, you know, he kind of steals and lies and runs out on people's houses, and it's about kind of addiction, and he's just this kind of promiscuous nightmare. And at the end of every chapter, he goes, "Oh, I was right, little cunt, in them days. It was terrible." It's done with such charm that, again, you know, it's kind of really, really dark material, presented almost as kind of stand-up and with a level of self-awareness. So there's been lots of me kind of walking around laughing out loud in the street, apparently to myself, while I've been listening to that one.
Oh, good. Well, this book is The Skeleton Key, and it makes me think every book, regardless of whether it's a fiction or fact, should be made to hide something somewhere in the world that the readers have to find, and there should be clues in. And I've got a book about testicles coming out, so I'm going to hide some golden balls around the country. It's made me think there isn't enough, but I think all books should be masquerade, and they should all have a prize.
There aren't enough golden testicles in the world.
Yeah, there aren't enough golden testicles, so I'm going to hide golden balls around the UK for you to find, and there'll be clues. It's a bit late because I've written the book and it's been published and I've done the audiobook, so I don't know how I'm going to get the clues in there, but I'll work something out backwards. Maybe for the next one, yeah, it will be fine. But look, this is a fan. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this. I don't read loads of novels, and so, maybe all novels are this good. I don't know. I'm surprised how strong, right? When you read a lot of books, you suddenly go, "Oh, everyone's really good at writing, aren't they?" It's slightly disappointing to find everyone so good. It's quite hard to do a really good book and everyone's really good.
Really, but this, good.
maybe I'm just getting lucky.
This
one's really good. I really recommend it, and I know people who listen to this podcast will love it. So buy The Skeleton Key by Erin Kelly. Thank you very much, Erin. Lovely to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
And thanks also to Chris Evans, not that one, for producing and directing the show.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.